We're studying about the great conflict of our age, the subject of whether there is a God. We pointed out last week that it has only been about 300 years that the very idea of atheism has gained much traction among mankind. And it seems that that growing belief, and that's what it is a faith, a growing belief that there is no God, and that everything that we see and know can be explained by science or things like that, is now a real challenge to those who profess Christianity as well as those of other religions as well. Well, we've dealt with for 2,000 years those of other religious faiths, but now we find ourselves being challenged by those who not only believe there is no God, but have gained a tremendous amount of influence in our culture to enforce their points of view upon the whole culture. And so references to God are being systematically removed from our public school systems. They've already been removed from our entire university educational systems. They're being removed from public life. Any references, any statues, any inscriptions, any scriptures. It's very little acknowledged in any kind of positive way in our news media or in our entertainment industry, Hollywood, as it's often referred to. So it's a battle for this age. And out of these two different points of view come many other consequences which we may not immediately recognize. Is there a creator, or are we alone in this universe? Is there such a thing as morality and therefore sin, the breaking of the laws of this creator? Or is morality simply the cultural mores and traditions of any given group of people that has come out of some kind of common consent by those people but has nothing to do with a real lawgiver who is eternal? Is there such a thing as redemption, being made right with God and salvation? Or is life just what you make it? Is there life after this? And therefore what we do here has some influence or definition as to what happens after life? Or is it totally materialistic and death is the end of existence? And has this God spoken? And has He revealed Himself? And is there a set of writings or other ways for us to know what that revelation is, what we as Christians would call inspired writings? Or as those who are on the other side would say, at the most, they're only inspiring, though flawed. But there's no such thing as inspired, since there is no one there to inspire them. It seems that mankind has always looked for the answers for certain things. Who am I? Where did I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? It's only the Christian faith, and before it the Jewish faith, upon which we came out of, had answers to that. Who are we? We're God's creation, made in His image, made to rule over this creation that He put us in. Where did we come from? He made us. Why are we here? To serve and obey Him and find the joy and fulfillment of that. And where are we going? There's a life after this. But for the atheist or the agnostic or the skeptic, those are three different categories. The atheist says there is no God. The agnostic says, I don't know if there's a God. The skeptic says, I'm doubtful about whether there's any supreme being. For them, when you say, who are we? Well, we are the product of natural forces, whether you call it evolution or something else, that we are the result of the evolving of lower forms of life up to us. But where do we come from? Well, that's where we came from. You go back far enough, it'll be some kind of primordial slime that has just the right molecules and environmental things around it that made it all suddenly happen, a spark, and life began. Why are we here? Can't answer that one. Where are we going? Nowhere. truthfully, without, you know, if we remove the humor out of that, that's what the other set of answers are. Now, that doesn't make us right and them wrong simply because we have completely different points of view about the world and ourselves and the past and the future. But that's what we want to talk about. We're wanting to talk about the God who is there and why we believe that is the most viable point of view. As we saw last week, Peter encouraged Christians in his day in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15 that they needed to be ready always to give an answer to those that asked them a reason for the hope that was in them. Sometimes people today use the word hope in the sense of meaning that which is fanciful and not achievable or not real. That's not the way the Bible uses the word hope. Hope simply meant that which was real but unseen. We have confidence in that which for which we hope, even though it's unseen. We hope for the second coming of Christ. We hope for God's rule over all the world one day after Christ comes. We hope for heaven. We hope for resurrection. We have not seen any of those things. That does not automatically make them unreal, however. We need to be able to give a reason for this hope we have. We need to be able to explain why we believe. Those on the other side explain why they believe. In a sense, we describe atheism as unbelief, but that's not really true. It's just unbelief in what we believe. They believe in something else. It is a belief system. And they have put their confidence in it. They trust it. They're sure of it. The Hebrew writer tells us what faith is. He's not defining faith so much as he's illustrating faith. In Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 1, we visited there already. Depending on your translation, you can tell the translators were looking for just the right words that would appropriately communicate the meaning in our modern English when it was originally written in the Greek of 2,000 years ago. And so if you read from the King James, it says something like this, Hebrews 11, 1. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Well, the words substance and evidence, some 400 years ago when the King James translation was made, those two words, substance and evidence, have changed in 400 years in English. And so they no longer carry entirely the same meaning they did then. And so more modern translations use other words that capture more probably of the meaning as we understand them today. And so when I read in the NIV, it says, now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. I'm blessed with the opportunity and a long habit of actually going to those resources I have that tell me more about what the Greek words mean. And so when it says, now faith is the substance, King James, now faith is being sure of, NIV. In the Greek language, the word there for substance is the Greek word hypostasis. Now, that doesn't mean a thing even to me except for what I've read on it. But the word stasis means standing or situation or condition. And hupo meant under. And so the literal Greek word hypostasis means that which stands under or provides a foundation for something. Hypostasis. So the writer here is saying, now faith is what provides the foundation, what undergirds, stands under what we're hoping for. Certainly if we don't have faith in something, then we don't hope for it. But the best we could do at that point is just have wishful thinking about it, but no confidence. But more than that, he not only says that faith is what undergirds or stands underneath what we hope for, but he also says, and the evidence, King James, are being certain of, the NIV, of what we do not see. And the Greek word here is a Greek word elenko or elencho, which was used in two senses by the Greeks either that which was the evidence of something or the conviction and confidence that came from the evidence. And so the writer here is telling us that not only is faith the undergirding of what we hope for, it also is a conviction and the confidence that came from the evidence of what we do not see. What? We can have evidence about things that are invisible? Oh, sure, all the time. There's a time-worn illustration that when I went out, you know, that's illustrated by when I went out and got in the car this morning and put my key in the ignition and I turned it. Something totally invisible to me took place. Not only invisible because it was under the hood and I wasn't looking under the hood, but because if I were looking under the hood, I would not have seen anything visible. As suddenly electricity, which is invisible, by and large, flowed through the wiring from my battery to my starter, and I turned that key, and then provided power to the spark plugs in my car as fuel and air was being pumped into those cylinders, and it fired off and the engine started. But it all began with something invisible. Is there proof? Is there evidence? Is there conviction and confidence that it's there? Yes. The Hebrew writer, without knowing anything about electricity probably, is saying that's what faith is. It's the conviction of things about things we do not see. And that is true whether we are a Christian believer, a Jewish believer, or an atheist unbeliever. They have faith. They have certain things that undergird what they believe in. And they're confident and have conviction about it. And so they live out of that. We all live by faith. It's just, what is our faith in? That is the question. And this faith, whether it's our faith or theirs, leads to actions. We've long used the passage in James chapter 2, where James, talking primarily, of course, or entirely perhaps, about the faith of the Christian that needs to be active, where he says, "For faith without works is dead, being by itself." He was arguing that real faith in something leads to action. Well, that's not only true in the Christian's life, it's also true in the atheist's life. Their confidence and conviction about the things they believe lead to certain ways of living and ways of thinking and ways of acting. Paul would tell the Corinthians about their faith that we walk by faith, not by sight. But now when he uses the word walk, that's, as we already know, is just another way of saying we live by faith. He isn't concerned about how they're putting one foot in front of the other, walk. He's concerned about how they live. We live by faith and not by sight. And his whole context there is that we believe in things we do not presently see. We believe in Jesus. We believe in God. We believe that not only we were created, but that we were put here for a purpose, and we believe there's a future. We walk, we live out of that faith. Some people, of course, live by sight. They're totally seem to be totally oblivious. Maybe they've just given up on the idea of knowing about the unseen, and so they live entirely based upon what they have right in front of them. The material things of life, their families, their jobs, their money. They walk by sight, but we walk by faith. It says back in our passage, our section in Hebrews 11, then, once we understand a little bit of what faith is like, it's that assurance we end up having because of the evidence, the conviction that has come. It therefore undergirds what we hope for. It's what we stand on as we wait for that which is still to come. But as he talks about that, then he starts to give illustrations of that, but we want to look first in verse 6, where he says, "And without faith," that is this conviction, this confidence in things unseen, things we hope for, "without faith it is impossible to please God." One of the things we believe in. "Because anyone who comes to Him must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who earnestly seek Him." There's a category of people in the world who claim to be believers in God. They might just be called theist. At the time of the founding of our country, there was a fairly popular minority movement of these people that were called deist. Some of even our founding fathers were deist. They believed that God existed, that some supreme being existed, but they were skeptical about almost everything else about Him. Has He spoken to us? Has He given us His will? Is there a revelation? Is a Bible from Him? Was Jesus His Son? Did He die for our sins? Will we stand in judgment before God one day? They didn't believe any of that, or at least had severe doubts about it, but they believed there was a supreme being. But just believing that He existed did them no good, shall we say, in their life, because they didn't seek Him. They just were convinced He was there. And then they lived their lives the way they thought was best. For their faith didn't lead to an action of diligently seeking Him. They were convinced in their own minds that there wasn't anything to seek because you wouldn't find it if you looked for it. And so, if God exists, and I'm not casting that as a doubt, but if He exists, we not only must believe, have a conviction and confidence that He exists, but we must be energized or activated to earnestly seek Him. And the majority of mankind, by one means or another, have in fact been doing that since the very beginning of time. And so then the Hebrew writer gives us these great examples of some of the great Jewish heroes of the Old Testament who not only believed that God existed, but their confidence in that had led them to act. And so he'll talk about Noah, who built an ark. He'll talk about Abraham, who not only abandoned where he had grown up and where his people live, but also came to believe that God was going to give him and his wife offspring, children, even though by the time he was 99 and she was 89, they had still not had child one. But he had the confidence and the faith that God would give them children, and he acted accordingly. About Joseph, about Moses, of whom the writer will say, who saw Him who is invisible, which means that in Moses' mind and his heart, even though he didn't see with his eyes, he saw God with his heart. His faith was the confidence of things unseen, about things unseen. And about Joshua, who believed that if he had faith in God and would lead the people to march around the walls of Jericho, that God would give them victory. And so he did. Now, we often can use other words besides just the word faith or belief or believe to describe what we're describing here. These synonyms in our language bring out other nuances or other aspects of this whole subject of faith or belief. We can use words, as we already have been using, like conviction. On one hand, in a legal sense, conviction means when someone has been found guilty of something, the evidence was sufficient to bring a conviction. But in our own life, the evidence needs to be sufficient to bring about conviction. Confidence. In that word, not only do we mean that we believe in something, but it empowers us in a certain way to act accordingly. Confidence. We talk about people who have no confidence. We talk about people who are confident. It's a part of the whole idea of faith or believing. Assurance. Another form of the word insurance. Only you don't have to pay for assurance with money. You might have to pay for it with other things, like your life. Assurance. Such confidence and conviction that something is true, that it relieves you of worry. It gives you this belief that is not shaken. Reliance is a word, a synonym for faith as well, because it means we will now put our weight down upon it. Remember, he said that faith is the substance, the undergirding, the foundation of that which we hope for. Reliance says we're willing to put our weight on that. We think it will hold us, it will support us. We can depend on it. We can rely on it. We can trust it. We will live in trust. We need to talk a little bit about the whole idea of proof or evidence. I have a large, for me at least, collection of books in my library on the subject of what's called evidences, Christian apologetics. People discussing what are the proofs, what are the evidences in support of what we believe. And some of those books point out that we have to be careful when you use the word proof, because proof really has two different meanings in our world. On the one hand, and this is the way we have to be careful with it, the word proof is often used to mean that beyond which there's any shadow or possibility of doubt. Now, it turns out there's not nearly as many areas in which there is proof as people sometimes would like you to think. But perhaps we could use an illustration such as if, you know, how much is 5 plus 1? Right now, my two older grandchildren in Lubbock are both working on their mathematics. The 5-year-old, who just turned 5 a couple of days ago, is trying to understand about addition. And he's trying to, you know, and so they use what is for us a traditional way of teaching that. They'll take 5 things and lay them down and say, okay, here's 5. What happens if we add 1 to it? Now how many do we have, Micah? Count them. Well, now you have 6. That's considered a proof, an absolute. As long as you're using, you know, and then you have to get all the mathematicians' disclaimers, as long as you're using the decimal system and all those kind of things. But there's another way, and it's the majority way, actually, that the word proof is used. It means enough evidence sufficient to draw a confident conclusion. And in all these different areas of life, there is this concept of evidence or proof for things. An area of logic. None of us were probably schooled in logic. At one time, that was a standard in schools to teach children logic, the whole idea of logic. That if you have a major premise or proposition and a secondary or minor premise or proposition, you can draw a conclusion from that. But there was always all sorts of ifs, ands, and buts involved. You know, it all depended on whether you couched it in the right terms. The sky is blue, major proposition. Barbara's jacket is blue. Does that mean her jacket is the sky? No. You know, that's faulty logic. And so you had to go through all sorts of things to understand how logic works. And yet, logic has within it, and we use logic all the time, and you hear it all the time being used to explain things or to justify things. But it's all based on what are your evidences, what are your proofs in order to justify the conclusions you've come to. In mathematics, we've only given a reference to that in the simple subject of addition. 2 plus 2 equals 4, 5 plus 1 equals 6, 24 divided by 8 equals 3. And yet the mathematician will tell you that the greater part of mathematics are not absolute proofs, as in the two simple examples I just gave, but, as I saw one writer say, are fuzzy proofs. And then he went on to explain what he meant. What is a fuzzy proof to a mathematician? Either it adds up or it doesn't, seems to me. But no, he said, there are many areas of mathematics in which it's not cut and dried, but in which the mathematician has finally accumulated enough evidence and indications that he draws a conclusion he's confident with. In other words, it's an inexact thing. But he's still confident in it, and then he'll move on from there to move on to other things. So mathematics has this whole subject of evidences and proofs. In the legal system, the one area where we probably know the most, or at least hear the most about evidence and proof and conviction and all those kind of things, we know in our legal system, in our country, that evidences have to be provided sufficient for a jury of 6 to 12 people to come to a conclusion as they're admonished by the judge that is beyond a reasonable doubt. And yet what has happened in that trial? Both sides, both those arguing for the guilt of someone and those on the other side defending that person, have both presented evidence, facts, materials, circumstances, eyewitnesses, all sorts of things to try to justify their conclusion that this person either is guilty or not guilty. And then it's left up to, most of the time, a panel of jurors to decide where does the evidence fall. And sometimes we know that there'll be a mistrial because the jurors will say, we can't decide. Sometimes the news media will get hold of something and they'll present all sorts of, try to slant it seems perhaps to us, to make it look like this person is really guilty. But then when the jurors come back, what do they say? Not guilty. The evidence was not compelling for them that this person was guilty. I think of the O.J. Simpson trial, for example. I think we already had him all convicted, imprisoned, and executed. And then what happens? Jurors say, not guilty. And then everybody has to explain how wrong the jurors were. I don't know if they were right or wrong. But I know that both sides had their very best opportunity to convince them. And one side was successful and one side was not. That's how evidence works. You collect enough of it so that one side prevails over the other, or not, in the legal system. In the scientific community, scientists would sometimes oversimplify their own work and claim that everything can be proven by science. And if it can't be proven by science, it can't be known. In fact, most scientists are honest enough to say that much of what they believe as absolute is actually matters of faith. Whether it's gravity or electricity or subatomic particles or astrophysics, what's out there in the universe, biology, the nuclear field, whatever it may be, a great deal of what they're totally confident is true is simply based upon collecting enough evidence, as they see it to be, that they become convinced that it's true, even though it's not totally unassailable. There's historical evidence. How do we know something happened in history? What's the evidence? There's the old thing about if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to see it, does it make a sound? That sounds like a sillyism to me. But in fact, it does address a matter of what is historical evidence. If there's no one there to see it, and there's never anyone to see the evidence that it happened, then from a historical standpoint, history can say nothing about it. There's no historical evidence. But on the other hand, if there was someone there, if documents were written, if relics were left behind, think of the pyramids in Egypt. We have, as far as I know, no actual written records that have come down to us about the building of most of the pyramids, but there they are. That's historical evidence. And even in day-to-day life, we deal all the time with this subject of evidence and proof. And so we hear something on the news. The weatherman shows us something on the screen, and there's this big green area moving into Odessa, and right in the middle of it is a yellow area, and right in the middle of that is a red area. And he says, severe weather is moving into Odessa. Well, some of us may go outside and look to see if we see anything on the horizon. The greater part of us will do what? Believe, based on that one bit of evidence. Because it's coming from where? A trusted source. Even though weathermen get plenty of knocks for being wrong a lot of the time, still, we tend to trust what they say, and it's coming over our news media, and so we believe that. Evidence is being presented. Is it ironclad? Is it unassailable? Is it proof in the sense there's absolutely no possibility that it could be anything else other than that? No. Does that make it unreal? No. Does that make it unbelievable? No. Can we put our confidence and trust in it? We almost always do. We read something in an encyclopedia or in a dictionary or even just in some other kind of publication that's trusted. Time Magazine, National Geographic, whatever it may be. Odessa American. We trust it. We believe it. We consider it as evidence. Again, that doesn't mean there might not be some other explanation, that there might be someone somewhere who could say this isn't true. But we put our faith and trust in it. Many other such things could be mentioned here. But I mention it because as we talk about the God who is there, when we talk about what's the evidence for Him being there, we're going to have to talk about a wide variety of different things, maybe no one of which is so compelling that as soon as everybody hears it, they're all say, oh, there's no need to talk any further. I'm convinced. There probably won't be any such. But at some point, enough evidence will be presented that everybody who is going to believe will, somewhere along the line. And those who are not going to believe, if you just kept on making evidence for the rest of the existence of the world, they still wouldn't believe. Because they're not going to be persuaded. They won't be convinced. Does that mean that it's not true just because some won't believe it? No, not at all. Any more than the fact that some may believe, and maybe this is even controversial even to some here, some may believe that man never actually landed on the moon and we never sent the Apollo series of flights to the moon and around the moon and on the moon and back from the moon. Does that mean it didn't happen? No. It just means some are not going to be convinced, even when all the evidence is presented to them. And so this is only an introduction to our subject. It's true, we would love for things to be cut and dried, black and white, with no other possible explanation. But that's not how life works. It doesn't work in all the rest of life, and it doesn't even work that way in the area of religion and faith. But at the same time, we can talk about evidence and proofs such that a large majority of people who have considered these things have come to believe them. Now, on the other hand, the unbeliever, the atheist or the agnostic or the skeptic, he has his own sets of supposed proofs and evidences. They're not convincing to us. They're convincing to them. We think they're mistaken. They think we're mistaken. They think we're stupid. You know, both sides. But we still need to evaluate the evidence and draw the conclusions. Very interestingly, at the very end of the book of Joshua, Joshua 24 and 15, after the Israelite people had come into the land of promise, the mighty power of God had been demonstrated to them in the opening up of the Jordan River so they could cross it, the great victory at Jericho when by seemingly totally supernatural means the walls fall down and they capture that city. They have many other victories over their enemies until finally the whole land is theirs. And now they're ready to disperse their army and everybody settle down and enjoy a normal life, which they'd never had until then. And Joshua gathers them together one last time and tells them, choose you this day whom you will serve. If you're going to serve the gods of the peoples we just conquered, the gods of the people we came out of back in Egypt, or the God that you've seen demonstrated in the power that we've seen around us for the last 7, 14, 21 years. He said, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. He was telling them, evaluate the evidence of what you have had put before you and decide what you're going to do about it. The God who is there.